What's different in today's age is we can start to see there's bigger changes possibly ahead, that instead of all of us having to accept that as the decades pass, we're going to grow older and weaker, our eyesight's going to fail, our stability is going to fail, there is now the possibility of therapies, medicines that will keep us younger much longer, possibly even indefinitely. So that's one of the transhumanist visions. It's called super longevity. And to be clear, it doesn't mean that we'll all be feeble and crotchety in our 90s and 100s. It means that we could be playing golf as well in our 90s and 100s, or even better than we do in our 30s and 40s and 50s.
Welcome to the Golfers Journal podcast, or rather, welcome to the future, presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne, and today we're looking beyond the fairway, beyond golf's horizons, and talking about the game with futurist and transhumanist, a wonderful friend of the pod, David Wood. Now, what is transhumanism, you say? Well, you're going to find out. That's why you're listening. But suffice to say, it's imagining a world with fewer and fewer human limitations. And as we see that happening in other parts of our lives, in our technology, healthcare, automation, etc., we thought, what will golf ultimately look like as our old limitations fade away? Now, this view of the future, there's a lot more good news in it than you might expect. So we hope you enjoyed the listen. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to all our sponsors, Titleist, LinkSoul, FootJoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, Scotty Cameron, and Charles Schwab. And especially thanks to all our members for supporting what we do at the Golfers Journal so we can bring you topics and conversations like this one. And the best way to make sure we can keep doing that is to share the Golfers Journal. And this is like the top sharing holiday of the year is right around the corner. Father's Day is coming. No easier or better Father's Day gift than a Golfers Journal membership. I mean, it's like nine gifts in one. You get the Golfers Journal. You get the beautiful book that it all started with. You're giving your dad community, the Broken Tea Society, friends, people to golf with around the world. You're giving him access to events, our international roster of member-only outings. You're giving him the art of storytelling, because beyond the book, we have the podcast, our digital content. It's all collected on our website, and it's there for members only. You can listen to authors reading their own work. You can download this stuff on any of your devices. You get discounts and exclusives as members. You'll never pay full price in our shop as a member. And of course, there's the annual gift that everybody loves, last year's putter covers from Links and Kings. Hugely popular. I don't know what next year's is going to be, but your dad's going to want to know. So get them the membership. Don't forget about the member locker. Every once in a while, cool things just show up in your locker. Link Soul Cash, etc. Another great perk of membership, and of course, the chance to earn even more rewards by referring friends, family, strangers to the Golfers Journal with your referral code. Every month, we have a new prize for winners, but if you refer one person this year, you're going to be in the running for that head-to-toe Titleist fitting, FootJoy, Scotty Cameron, the whole deal. Now, if your dad already has, and let's not just make this about dads. I mean, this is a great gift for moms, wives, sisters, husbands. It's obviously, like I just said, it's a gift that keeps on giving. But should dad have the membership already, consider something from our shop. Our shop is fully stocked, looking good. And if you've already got them something from the shop, then you might want to sprinkle in a dozen Pro V1s or Pro V1Xs from Titleist, because they are all new, redesigned from core to cover for more precision, distance, and consistency. Titleist, the number one ball the world over. And you don't want to give dad the number, like two ball or three ball. I mean, what does that say on Father's Day? You could ruin his day with substandard. You got to go number one ball on Father's Day and every day. And if that isn't enough to impress dad, or if your dad's been really good this year, of course, bring him to Olympic Hills. Our most recent event dropped recently. A few spots left. My Minnesota friends are raving about this golf course. 1968. So it flies a little bit under the radar because it's sort of just coming into its own. But you know that we only take you to the special places. And when we do it right. The food, the beverage, the gifts, the awards, the giveaways to everyone. You know, we don't do the koozies and T-shirts. You're going to be getting top quality merchandise from our sponsors. So sign up now before all the spots are gone. They're going to go fast. I predict they will go very fast. And I can predict such things now because I've spent time with a futurist, and now I have this new sensitivity to such things. Seriously, though, it was a real treat talking to someone whose job is to basically think beyond limits, to imagine beyond the known world. What a great gig. So big thanks to David Wood for giving us his time and his perspective and focusing it for just a while on the golf world. Let's turn it over to David and imagine a world without limits, where all our golf excuses will have disappeared, whether we like it or not. David Wood, David, can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us here on the podcast. Want to talk about your background, what you do as a futurist. What is a futurist? How does one become a futurist? We should start by saying this is a golf podcast, and you are a golfer.
I am a golfer, but I'm not going to trouble the scorer in any of the club competitions. I have a handicap in this new world golf system of about 23.5. And yesterday I had 3 pars, and I was happy to have 3 pars. So that's the kind of golfer I am.
3 pars with 23.5. That could win you a little hardware. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, the ball's going in the water and less in the other holes lessen that possibility. But I enjoy golf.
Where are you playing it? Where are you coming to us from right now?
I'm in southwest London, a place called Surbiton, which is on the Thames, just around from slightly more famous places like Richmond and Kingston. Mm-hmm. I play most of my golf at a club called Burr Hill, which was founded in 1907. There's 2 lovely courses there.
Excellent. Young by British standards. And
well, quite. And when I was up in the northeast of Scotland, I occasionally dabbled on courses that claimed to be the 7th oldest in the world or some such thing.
Yeah, exactly. There were a lot around that 7th Fraser Burr. There are a lot of clubs that claim that lineage, but we're not here to talk about the past necessarily. Looking into the future, how does one become a futurist? I don't imagine there are crystal balls involved. Probably a little more to it than that.
So I worked in the high-tech industry. I worked with mobile computers and smartphones long before Apple and Android and Google became well-known. So my software was in some of the first handheld organizers and then in some of the smartphones that companies such as Nokia and Motorola and Ericsson produced from about the year 2000 onwards. And in that job, you have to anticipate what's coming next. It's an industry in which every year the phones have more hardware power. They have better networking connectivity. So it's not enough just to create the applications that take advantage of today's technology. So we had to look ahead. And we would argue all the time, what are people going to want to do with these devices? And that's how, in a sense, I became a futurist, thinking about the future implications of technologies that we could see and how it would actually change the lives of ordinary people. I vividly remember, this is a bit further back in history, about 1995, we software engineers were sitting around the lunch table as usual, and our head of marketing came in, and he poured scorn at the idea that any real people would ever use the internet. You know, it was a 9-day sensation. You know, it was something that had a bit of a news attention, but would soon fade away. I don't think he really believed that. He was just poking our tires to see how firm our views were. But it was always my view that technology will change many areas of life, not just what we do when we're being technical, but how we look after our health, how we learn things, and yes, how we exercise and how we entertain ourselves, including on a golf course.
Indeed. And, well, when we're talking about the smartphones, just before we get to the golf, when you were thinking about how these devices would be used, could you have ever possibly predicted, or did you predict the way that's, you know, we basically carry the whole world around in our pockets?
Some parts were relatively easy to imagine. There already was, in the early days of the internet, some impressive online information stores, such as Wikipedia, such as the elementary search engine. So we could imagine that people would carry more things with them. And we used to argue amongst ourselves, people, whether people would ever read books on devices with screens. And the old-fashioned amongst us said, you can never replace paper. Paper has a unique feel. And that's true, but there are advantages to being able to search. There are advantages to being able to carry books that aren't so heavy. So now when I go on trips, I don't carry a whole suitcase full of books with me that are heavy and are expensive to buy. I carry them in my smartphone. But there have been many surprises. We did not predict Twitter and how Twitter has transformed the enjoyment of golf competitions, for example. We did not anticipate many of the other applications, the ways in which these devices would be given to very young children to entertain them even before they can speak. Sometimes young children are holding pads which have got marvelous images of fish floating around. We would have thought that is a scandalously irresponsible parenting, relying on technology to help out there. But, you know, ideas change. And as technology has more possibilities, at first, often people resist it, and then people come around. And I think that's how technology will be increasingly adopted in some elements of golf, too.
Yes, indeed. It might be scandalously irresponsible parenting, but I know I'm guilty of it myself. What choice do we have? So when you talk about technology as it impacts, you know, beyond smartphones, as it impacts every part of our life, is that sort of where we get into this idea of transhumanism? Explain transhumanism to the listeners and to me.
The transhumanism means transcend, going beyond human limits. So we humans have always wanted to go beyond our limits. You know, it's part of human nature to desire to exceed nature. So we've always wanted to be able to run faster, or if not running, then get on horses, or in due course, get on carriages or cars. We've always wanted to be able to propel things further through the air than we can do just with our native hands. So we have enhanced our ability. What's different in today's age is we can start to see there's bigger changes possibly ahead, that instead of all of us having to accept that as the decades pass, we're going to grow older and weaker, our eyesight's going to fail, our stability is going to fail, there is now the possibility of therapies, medicines that will keep us younger much longer, possibly even indefinitely. So that's one of the transhumanist visions. It's called super longevity. And to be clear, it doesn't mean that we'll all be feeble and crotchety in our 90s and 100s. It means that we could be playing golf as well in our 90s and 100s, or even better than we do in our 30s and 40s and 50s, because we will be, in various ways, rejuvenated.
I like that idea. I like it a lot. I mean, is that, I don't think that's happening in my lifetime, though. So what is that, when you're, as a futurist, as a transhumanist, how far ahead are you looking?
Well, I think it's hard to foresee too far ahead, and it's simply because of the pace of change. There is an exponential curve in the power of computers, for example. People sometimes call this Moore's Law. It's named after one of the founders of the Intel company that provides the chips that go inside many of the computers. And Gordon Moore, a long time ago, in 1965, he noticed that every year or so, they were putting twice as many transistors into the integrated circuits. So right back in 1959, at the start of the Silicon Age, you could only put one transistor onto an integrated circuit, and then two, and then four, and 16. And he dared to speculate in 1965 that that trend would continue another 10 years. As has happened, it's more or less continued to the present time. It's slowed down a bit, but it means that every 18 months or so, you can, for the same cost, get computers that have twice the storage, can compute twice as fast, and there are similar laws that says we can transmit more data over the network. And you say, well, what's twice as much? But if you do that several times, if you go out 5 years, you get 18 months three times, and that doubles three times, which gives you an eightfold improvement. And if you do it 10 times, if you go out 10 years, then you can get maybe a hundredfold improvement. And then it's so hard to imagine what will be possible if these continue. And the biggest thing that's hard to predict is when we use this technology, not just to reprogram our devices, but to reprogram ourselves. You know, we might get an upgrade. In a few years' time, you and I might be chatting and I'll be wearing smart glasses and I might get a little message up on the screen. Update available. Update available. Would you like to upgrade your DNA? We have got a few bug fixes for your DNA in the same way that we sometimes upgrade our phones today. So is that conceivable? It is. We are already using some upgrades to parts of our biology. There are some diseases like sickle cell anemia, terrible diseases which cause lots of pain. And there are now ways to reprogram people's blood, their white blood cells and others, to lessen the damage caused by these diseases. Marvelous. So we're not going to reprogram our whole DNA overnight, to be clear, but over time we might improve ourselves in various ways. And what might this mean? Yeah. 50 years out, it's just too hard to add it all up. So my message is we have to be ready to chop and change quite quickly, frankly.
Indeed. Because when you're talking, you know, just that notion there about doubling every year or every so many years or every 18 months or, you know, if you just look at that broadly enough, I mean, what you're really talking about, it's some of these ideas are sort of, you're playing around with the notion of the infinite, which is a big, beautiful, scary, wonderful, even spiritual idea that I think is behind. I mean, it's a rabbit hole I'm interested in and could go down quite deeply because I think it's sort of at the core of universe and spirituality and all those things. But before we go too deeply in that direction, talking about biotechnology, talking about upgrading our DNA, becoming better, more physical specimens. I mean, that's something that directly ties to golf. And you know, we already sort of, we see it in all sports already with all the controversies over, you know, performance enhancing this, that, and the other. How do you think, or how would you foresee players being able to better themselves from a biology standpoint to become better golfers?
So this is a moving target. What is accepted at one stage may be rejected later on and then accepted again. People obviously have stimulants that can make them stronger and bulk up. And generally we say, oh, steroids are dangerous. You shouldn't use that kind of thing. And somehow it's unfair. Every main sport has its own laws about what kinds of drugs you can take and can't take. And it's often quite unclear because there are drugs which can be used to treat diseases in some circumstances, but in other circumstances, they might give people more stamina, make them more efficient in processing oxygen, and so forth. So there is a gray line as to what we as a society will endorse as being good sportsmanship and what we will shy away from and say, hey, this is a bit unfair. And I suspect that's going to change quite a lot. But we have golfers such as Bryson DeChambeau, who famously did various experiments on himself. And he has said, I believe, in some places he thinks it will be possible to use changes in his metabolism, changes in his diet, changes in treatments to live 150 years. So he is sort of a transhumanist making that claim. And others are looking at him partly enviously, partly worried, and thinking, what could we learn from him without maybe being quite so risky? And I think there's going to be a lot of such discussions. We will find ways in which we can make it better for us to hit the ball cleanly and crisply and long into the distance.
Do you think that there's a future in which we have to separate professional golf into natural golfers versus enhanced golfers? And that could probably be in all sports where we have to embrace enhancement and say, I guess in golf we have it now with hickory golf versus modern people who are playing modern equipment, right? But it's probably an idea we're going to have to get used to in all sports that, you know, at some point there's just our ability to genetically alter ourselves might just become a part of what we do.
And it's not just genetically modifying ourselves. It may be that we will have technology that coaches us. and speaks to us even in the moment, a little bit like a voice in our heads. We might have small buds in our ears which speak to us from time to time, give us the advice, or indicate that some of our blood pressure or our sweat or some electrolytes in our body indicate things about our swing, indicate things about our mood. It might be just speaking in our ears, giving us the right mantra, as it were, or the right music to calm us down. So that if we make a bad swing at a golf ball and we intend to go from bad to worse, which is the story of my golf often, sadly, instead there'll be something that just says the right thing in my mind, in my ears, to put me in the right mood. So I'll put that bad shot right out of the way. Mm-hmm. So there could be modifications, not in our biology, but in our feedback loops, including our the sensors that are built into our clothing, into our watch, and so on. And you're quite right. There are discussions as to what should be allowed and what isn't allowed. And even just now, you can take something onto the course, which tells you how far it is to the hole. But there are various other sensors which aren't allowed, I understand, in terms of measuring the wind and so forth. So what's allowed and what isn't allowed? And you're quite right. There could be different competitions in which there are different rules. But I think that's going to be hard to keep stable, and that people are going to have pressure all the time. They may say, well, okay, we're allowing people to have stimulants here, but only some kinds of stimulants and not other kinds of stimulants. It's a bit like the challenges at the Paralympics. How do you divide up who's allowed to compete in which classes? That's hard. Yeah. And the other thing is people who are transgender. To what extent do you let somebody who was physically born a man and is now a woman compete in women's sport? And there's no easy answer, frankly, and I don't think there's going to be straightforward easy answers in the evolution of the conditions applicable to golf. And we're just going to have to keep thinking about it, keep talking about it, and figuring out in the circumstances what makes most sense.
Fair point. And it's going to be a headache for the USGA and RNA, I imagine, to as technology continues to advance. It's really interesting, not just because we focus, when we talk about technology, we focus on, okay, the ball goes too fast, drivers are too forgiving or whatever. You know, we really look at equipment, but that's pretty interesting to think that that golfers are going to improve in other ways. In fact, in limiting equipment, that might be the simplest sort of thing. how do you limit someone from becoming too strong? How do you limit someone from becoming too smart with the aid of, I guess, you know, this sort of artificial intelligence? You know, I think we all have an idea of what, or we think we know what artificial intelligence is, but what is it? I mean, you've probably worked with it. I mean, what is artificial intelligence to you?
It's a big thing. There are many aspects of artificial intelligence. We already experience it to an extent when we go on Netflix or YouTube. When we finish watching one thing, it offers a suggestion. You like that? You might like this. And it makes its decision based upon what other people who liked something also happen to like. And when there are some identifiable features that you've got in common with them. And when you go onto a dating site, how do you get matched with potential matches? It's using algorithms. How do you get accepted or rejected for job interviews or for mortgage applications? There are algorithms there which aren't they're far from perfect, but they do simplify some of the decisions of the humans who would otherwise have to spend a lot of time going through hundreds of applications, perhaps. So we've got some simple AIs today. And when we try and talk to our phones, when we try and type into our phones, often that simple AI helps us. We type a few words and it comes up with what it thinks we are trying to type. And often it's quite impressive. You know, I type BU and the map automatically shows me Burhill Golf Course. Oh, yes, it knows I've typed that before. And there are other things it can identify. But it often gets things wrong, especially when we are doing something less common, less useful. And it's the same when we talk to our devices, which you can increasingly do. You can call out to your device and ask it a question, and quite often it gets it right. If it's a standard kind of thing, but other times it gets it wrong. Well, in the future, these devices will understand us even more. They'll understand us better because they've got bigger silicon brains. They'll understand us better because they've been monitoring more data. They know more what people like me tend to ask for. And it will also have watched me more often. And in principle, they'll almost become like our best friend. You know, when we are learning to drive a car or when we're learning to play golf, sometimes people who are close to us aren't the best guides because they say something to us, well-meaning, but it rubs us up the wrong way. And we think to them, how do you know what I'm trying to do? But a really good friend or a really good coach will find exactly the right words, exactly the right mood, exactly the right form of explanation that will get the message across to us. So I think in the future, an AI will be gathering information about how we are playing golf, how we swing, how we grip the club, the way we turn our body, and it will find exactly the right thing to guide us with and say, concentrate on this, and it will give us one thing in a way that a really good golf coach can do today, but that will be much more widely distributed. Now, we won't be able to wear these things when we're playing in real competitions, probably, but while we're learning, while we're practicing, we'll have that. And that may help us to raise our game. And then we'll go somewhat naked onto the golf course without the intelligent assistance, but we will have been coached well enough that our game will be better. And that's some of the ways in which AI could help us become better golfers and help us to enjoy the game more.
So we're going to get better. That's, it seems inevitable, right? If there, if the theme here is sort of this is progress, why wouldn't that translate to our golf?
On the other hand, we don't want the game to become too easy. Sure. And so golf designers will surely react to the different ways in which people play. And there will be more challenging golf courses designed with bunkers in more awkward positions and with runoff areas that make it more demanding that the ball must be placed in exactly the right location. So I'm not saying that we're going to end up getting a 20 below par in every round. The courses will modify, but in a way, the game will be more enjoyable. The game will be exciting, but more enjoyable too.
As we always say, you know, when we get in debates about equipment and design, et cetera, you know, we say, you know, if you just play golf, did you come off and think, oh, I made too many birdies today? You know, until that happens, I'm not terribly too worried about it, but people do fear AI, right? And maybe it's the hangover from 2001, A Space Odyssey, that this notion that HAL is going to take us all down. Is artificial intelligence something to be afraid of?
It's something we need to be careful about. The examples I gave earlier of AI deciding whether we should get an interview for a job or whether we should get a mortgage, they often go wrong. And sometimes they go wrong in ways that reflect the worst biases of society. Sometimes women are rejected from getting a job interview because in a corporation, typically in the past, they've employed more men than women. And the algorithm has decided, well, in that case, it looks like women shouldn't be employed here. And even if you take the names of people off the CVs, off the resumes, there's still often little clues in the resume which lead the AI to determine, oh, this is probably a woman. Therefore, we probably shouldn't offer her an interview. So that's just one way in which AI can get things worse. More controversially, AIs are making some of us angrier and more tribal and more divisive on social media. Why? Because in a way, AI wants to know what we're going to click on. It wants to send us advertisements that we're going to click on so it makes more money. And if we're in a particular mood, we are more likely to click on various types of adverts. And so we often, when we watch one video, get sent something that's a little bit more extreme, a little bit more intense, and we can get down a rabbit hole before we know it. And sadly, social media can amplify an initial slight tendency towards a political stance into something that makes us feel much more strongly. Hey, we belong in this political tribe and all these other guys over there, whether they're blues or reds or greens or any other color, they are somehow bad. And this is what AI today is already doing. And then we get fake videos, we get fake audio, and sometimes it's funny, sometimes we like it. Sometimes we're glad when we have an opportunity on our app when we take a picture and, oh, there's something in the background that we don't like there, a person who just jaywalked into the scene, and we can press a button on the phone app to remove it. Hey, that's fake picture, but it's good. Well, increasingly, we can have these fakes causing us to reach wrong conclusions. And sadly, there is a terrible war taking place at this very moment as we're doing this recording. And sadly, it looks like people on both sides are faking videos of atrocities and exaggerating. And it's driving people into less rational states. So there is reason to fear what AI will do. There's reason, therefore, to have exactly the kind of conversation that you and I are doing now. And lots more of it, to figure out how do we get the best of this technology without inadvertently stumbling into a bad situation that we no longer have control over.
For sure. And perhaps less consequential, but when you think of one of the things with AI, and we touched on this, talking about, say, teaching golf pros, is the reduction in the need for human beings when it comes to golf. So if you're going to get better feedback, you know, we're already seeing this with, you know, chips in golf clubs that are telling you exactly how far you hit. You know, game improvement is becoming more technical and digital. And, you know, if that continues to where, okay, golf is instructed by artificial intelligence, that where artificial intelligence can take into account exactly how far you hit a particular club, take into account all the wind and factors, no need for a caddy. I can imagine golf. How about golf course maintenance? That would seem to be certainly be an area where environmentally would be much more efficient if you had, you know, electric powered everything, taking care of the golf course, not using an ounce too much, you know, a bit too much energy in any different spot. And I've actually played some courses out at Sylvie's Valley Ranch in Oregon, where they already use technology to sort of keep a very close record of exactly how much water they have to put in the golf course and where, right? So that they are, you know, being more environmentally conscious in terms of their inputs through the use of technology. So what about technology turning golf, replacing everyone but the golfer?
Well, that is a trend.
Yeah.
On the golf course maintenance, we have, maybe not on the golf course, but on the driving ranges, there are little robots that go around picking up the balls rather than having a human go around and picking them all up. I don't think we've got them yet, but in due course, there might be machines that go out on the fairways and repair divots instead of the tedious job that greenskeepers need to do.
Right.
I don't think we're going to see technology replacing all golf professionals anytime soon. But I say this, that golf professionals who use technology will probably replace golf professionals who don't use technology. That the coaches that are able to take best advantage of, well, they already do it, the smartphones that take videos of your swing. So the teachers will say, look, here's you swinging. Here's your swinging superimposed on that of, I don't know, Scotty Scheffler or Rory McIlroy. You're quite close in swinging type, although, of course, the other guy hits the ball much further than you. And you can see that you could tweak this bit of your swing. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're using technology to make themselves more effective coaches. So that trend is probably going to increase. And the nature of the golf professional's job is going to change. And rather than fighting it, rather than saying, no, we're not going to have that technology in here, thank you, we're going to keep doing things the traditional way, I think it's wise to constantly adapt so that you keep the best of the classical systems, but where appropriate, you draw on what the technology can do to make some of your coaching and other golf professional tasks easier and quicker. And therefore, you can still, for a while at least, as a golf professional, add value that the technology can't yet provide.
That's very interesting. And how about architecture and golf course design, right? If you think in terms of maximum efficiency and using every ounce of the land in the most effective way, maybe in the most environmentally friendly way, maybe, you know, getting the most out of each parcel of land that you can get. An algorithm is probably going to solve that puzzle better, you know, more effectively than the human mind can. And that's hard, you know. I think golf course design is art, and art is something that will hopefully always remain in the realm of the human mind versus the artificial intelligence. And that, but nonetheless, I can certainly see where a computer would look at, you know, using GPS or a topo map and say, and map out, okay, here is how you can get the longest golf course, or the quickest golf course, or the easiest to maintain golf course. It'll be interesting. And frankly, maybe there already are programs out there that are doing that. I don't know.
I think you could be right. But I think, again, there's scope for combinations of AI skills and human skills. There might be a piece of land and you put the details of it into the AI, or indeed the AI can work out parts by itself. And then it will come up not just with one course, but it might come up with a range of courses and say, here's say three choices for a really good design. And then the human architects will review them, and using their own deeper intuition, which maybe can't so easily yet be turned into an algorithm, the humans might choose one of the designs over another one.
That makes sense. Now, something in the future that is developing and changing with time, as we have so much more vying for our attention, our attention spans getting shorter. And that's one of the things when you look at golf's future, you know, those three sort of things that seem to always hold golf back: it takes too long, it's too hard, and it's too expensive. Let's look at the first one. It takes too long. Do you see that with our shrinking attention spans, and with, you know, we've all had a lot of time, as a positive side effect of quarantine, but, as our lives resume, get to their normal busy, pace, how do we deal with that first issue of golf taking too long? Do you think that changes?
Well, some people will be happy to take as long as we do currently. But there will always be a segment of the market who will be grateful for the chance to get a good golf experience in less time. And one way in which more people are getting a kind of good golf experience these days is inside the driving ranges, which are equipped with more of the virtual golf scenarios, with the ball flight tracers from Pro Tracer or Top Tracer, and then with the screens that give you more of a feeling that you actually are walking along Pebble Beach or the old course in St. Andrews. And of course, it's not exactly the same, but there are many advantages that some people appreciate from going in this virtual golf environment. First, if you hit a really bad ball, you don't have to spend ages looking for it. You know, you're positioned exactly to where the ball has gone. Secondly, you don't get swept by rain and wind. And you can complete the whole course comfortably within an hour. So it's not, of course, the same as playing in the real scenario, but it could be enough for many people. And so that is, in some ways, a threat to traditional golf courses, that some of the people who might come and play there would instead opt for more of the time on these virtual courses. But again, I think there's scope for a combination. So I think there will be people who some of the time improve their golf in virtual golf, and still, at least maybe once or twice a week, depending on their circumstance, they will go and play on a real course too. But then there's the possibility of going to a real course and having shorter competitions. And I gather there is a variant golf tour that's being discussed just now, suggested, well, maybe we don't have to play 72 holes in the competition. We'll play just 54 holes. And they will last less time, because instead of everybody starting on T1, they'll start in so-called shotgun. Mm-hmm. So we'll get the job done quicker. And it's difficult to decide. Are these things abominations, or are these things sensible progress? Are they concessions to people wanting to see competitions finish quicker? So I think there's bound to be experimentation here. And there probably will still be the classic 4-day long competitions that we know and love, sometimes even drifting into a fifth day when there's a long tie break or weather conditions. But there will probably also be shorter matches too. And that's the trend in other sports. It's been the trend in cricket, which maybe isn't very well known in the USA, but in Britain, where I grew up, and in Australia and so on, there's much more shorter games, one-day matches instead of the five-day test matches, which were de rigueur when I was a young boy.
Mm. No, that's a good comparison, actually. And yeah, the trend is certainly in golf. There's a lot of, you know, nine-hole courses are getting much more popular. Par three courses, short courses are hugely popular. So this pressure, this push to shorten things, to tighten things up, to provide more value in a shorter amount of time and for less money and using less physical space. You have to imagine that trend continues. And also the way that we're going to consume golf tournaments, right? Do we have 4 days to... we sit down and watch 4 days of coverage, 72. I know I will for sure. But is that in the future? Is that the way? Or now, I mean, you can already like watch one player. You will have the ability to probably, you know, to log on and just watch the shots that you want to hit from each tournament. So does the tournament need to progress over 4 days, over 72 holes? I don't know. It's going to be it's up for debate, I suppose.
I think we should be ready to make some experiments and then figure out what's working and what's not working.
Indeed.
I mean, so even the rules of golf changed like recently with more emphasis on ready golf. Maybe that's not in the main competitions, but we were all told, you know, we've got to be ready to play out of turn sometimes. You don't wait for the person who's furthest away necessarily to hit. Why? It's so that the games can proceed more quickly.
Ready golf, leave the pin, you know, move it along more quickly. Absolutely. You had just touched, David, on this virtual golf experience. And that's something, you know, that people are, I'm interested to get, you know, whether you have a simulator in your house or you go play on a virtual golf course. But the difference between is that virtual golf or augmented golf, you know, this augmented reality and virtual reality. What are the differences between those two ideas?
So augmented reality is when you are playing in a real golf course, but you are wearing a headset, which will give you extra information. Now, I thought 10 years ago that we would have this a lot sooner because 10, 20, 15 years ago, everybody was talking about something called Google Glass, that you could have glasses that you would look through and you would also see information about what you're looking at.
What happened with Google Glass? My friend paid a bunch of money for it.
It turned out to be much harder than people had thought. You could only see information about a tiny so-called field of view, which wasn't a very pleasant experience. The battery life wasn't so good. And there was a lot of social kickback. People were called glass holes or something similar if they would wear it. And I don't think we've seen the last of such devices. I think other companies, whether it's Apple or Microsoft or Facebook, are going to come up with headsets. And not just for virtual reality, which is when you go into a totally new created place, but you are in the real world, but you are shown much the same as you show on your golf watch, how far it is to the ditch, how far it is to a bunker, how far it is to the front of the green and back of the green. But you'll see that in your visual field up here as you look around. And as you move your head, you might also see wind speed superimposed. So that is augmented reality. And that is useful for training, of course, as well. And maybe in the future, all the golfers will have that instead of caddies telling them about wind speed and how far it is to the different course objects. Maybe that will be built into the equipment in at least some competitions. The virtual golf that we play is not in a real golf course. It's typically in bays, specially constructed, sometimes two or three levels, but you have a screen alongside that shows you the views of the different courses. So you see the various buildings that would be part of the course. My ball is smashed into buildings many a time on the virtual golf, which I'm glad that didn't happen in real life. just slightly wayward shots, especially if it lands on the road and it bounces a long way. But you get more of an experience of actually being there. You don't have the tedium of walking to the ball. Conversely, you don't get the pleasure of the real nature, but you get at least some of the experience of thinking that you're playing on the various holes, the dog legs and the special shortcuts that you might try, or the tiger lines if you want to be ambitious with a particularly hard shot over some trees. So you get some of that experience. You typically don't get the combination of putting there as well. And that's something that may come in due course. So when your ball lands on the green, there's, at least in the system where I play, which is on a World of Golf setup, instead of trying to putt, you've got a target practice. And the closer you are to the hole in the virtual game, the larger the target area is. Yeah. So it's different from real golf there. It's also not quite the same when you land in a bunker. You know, coming out of a bunker in the virtual golf isn't as challenging as coming out of a bunker in a real golf. But over time, that may modify as well.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, if all these, this technology seems to get better every year, now the putting is a little better, you know. So if it gets to the point where we can play all the shots and we can play all these golf courses, we can feel the conditions, where it's 360 degrees immersive, where we get the smells and the temperatures and all these things. I mean, because golf otherwise takes up so much space, because it takes so much expense and so much, inputs, whatever, to grow the grass otherwise, and it's not a simple matter. Do you see golf eventually sort of at some point moving into the metaverse?
There will be a lot of golf in the metaverse, but I don't think it's going to completely go into the metaverse. There will be at least some of the time when we will be playing in ground reality, or base reality. And it's true, there may be different pressures on land use. I think that's going to change for all kinds of reasons anyway. I think land use will change because some of our current agricultural practices emit lots of greenhouse gases. And it might be alternative ways of growing meat in industrial laboratories that don't require sentient animals. I think that's going to be a large trend that's coming. It's not only better through not having to slaughter real living, breathing animals. It requires a lot less water. It is less use of land. And there's no need to have antibiotics to fend off infections, because these laboratories, or these industrial premises, will be already free from diseases. So their meat will be healthier. And that will allow a lot of our current land use to be transformed. Because a lot of our land use is much more than is set aside for golf courses. A lot of our land is set aside to grow crops to be eaten by animals as they grow, and then we turn them into hamburgers or steaks. In the future, not too far away, I think this is a trend that's going to accelerate. We'll see much more of our meat grown not on farms anymore. And so there will be different uses for our lands, and maybe there will be in some cases more golf courses rather than less, but possibly different types of golf course.
I like that view of things. Are there any other, I wouldn't have made the connection between our ability to manufacture meat as being a net gain for golf. Is there anything else out there in your vision of your transhumanist view that you see, okay, this could be good for, whether it's golf courses, what we talked about, you know, the playing of golf getting a little bit easier perhaps, but any other developments on the horizon that might have an impact on us as golfers?
There's the online community aspect of golf. Mm-hmm. One important driver for people to enjoy golf is the social dynamics of it. You know, the 19th hole is incredibly important. And sometimes people may even skip the first 18 and go straight to the 19th hole. So are there ways to magnify the golf community using technology? And for me, Twitter, it does this. You know, when I'm watching a golf competition, whether it's the Masters or the Ryder Cup, I've got my phone screen open alongside it and watching for the comments. And sometimes there's wisdom in the crowd. People can point out things that the commentators haven't latched onto. And so that gives me information. But other people form into groups and they may be chatting away excitedly to each other, changing their estimates for whether John Rahm's going to pull through or whether it's going to be Scottie Scheffler who catches him up, or I guess as a Brit, I should sing the praises of Rory McIlroy or Paul Casey or others. So there might be some change in that aspect of the golf experience as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you're touching on something there that is of particular interest to us here at the Golfers Journal, because we are, you know, the golfers, this whole debate of, you know, talking about the future of things, where things are going, it's a discussion we have all the time. And the Golfers Journal was sort of born as, you know, we began as print only. So we, not that we were sort of flying in the face of where technology was going, but, you know, we were zigging while golf writing and golf communication, golf media was zagging, and people responded to that. So like you said, maybe in the future, it's not, you know, people, if we're consuming everything digitally, there becomes that people miss print or they miss paper. And that's been, that was something that was of an advantage for the Golfers Journal. But as we go forward, we have the Broken Tee Society, which is our virtual clubhouse in the clouds, you know, where our members are communicating and, you know, planning golf and sort of all those sorts of things that would go on in a clubhouse is happening, like you said, online. You know, our stories are all available digitally. They're recorded. We have podcasts. So we're using technology to help tell better stories. Where do you see the future of storytelling going in terms of print, digital, experience? Are we going to consume stories now through something in our ears, something in our glasses?
Well, part of it will be that suddenly people realize they would like to find out something more about a person that they hadn't realized it might even be of interest to them. They're watching a competition and there's a dark horse person coming through the field and they suddenly are interested in stories about this person. So there has to be access on demand. And it can be quite hard to find that in print journals because, you know, you don't know which page is on. And even what's written there may not be quite enough, you know. Is it true that this golfer dated this other golfer or this tennis player and so on? Mm-hmm. So there should be easy access on demand to information. But we can also talk about the creation of these stories. We talked about how technology is changing the life of golf professionals. Well, famously, technology is changing the life of journalists too. For some kinds of sport, you can just feed in the raw statistics and AI will come up with something that looks like it's written by a human talking about this and that. The AI will weave a plausible narrative as to the story. And that means the magazine no longer needs to pay for humans to do that particular kind of fairly standard grunt work. So it's not the most enjoyable part of a golf journalist's job, but it can be taken out of their hands. And so surely the work of journalists is going to change too. And I'm not saying technology will replace journalists, but I will say that journalists who take advantage of technology will displace journalists who can't take advantage of technology.
Well said. Yeah. And that's something, like I said here, that we're very conscious of. I hope I'm not replaced by a computer. If you just feed them tell the computer, send it pictures of Ross Sapena in Ireland and it can spit out a feature about it. Probably, I could probably do a little bit better, but I don't know. Those algorithms, we'll see. Do you see, you know, at the end of the day, is this all for golf and taking this sort of transhumanist view of it? Is this a net positive or is there more to be gained or more to be lost?
Well, there's another kind of gain that maybe we could have talked about earlier, which is people do have golf injuries, sadly, from stressing and straining in ways that turn out not to be wise. So I think that the same system that might be monitoring us, improving our swing from time to time, might play an important role in preventing golf injuries. It may not prevent all of them. You know, if we drive a buggy off the edge of somewhere steep, well, even then, the buggy, I know, I take that back. The buggy itself should stop us. The buggy should say, no, I'm not going over here. Sorry. I know you want to go there, but I know something that you, a human driver, don't know. So maybe the technology will help us to remain in good shape for longer. I talked earlier about it might rejuvenate us, but even before that, it might stop us from having injuries. I mean, there is the sad case of people being hit by golf balls as well. So possibly, you know, when you hear the word four being shouted, sometimes you've no idea whether the ball's coming to you or not. And possibly little monitors in your head might see the ball coming before you do. I mean, maybe that's a bit fantastical. I don't know if such an application is coming anytime soon. But overall, I think that the technology should be able to help us continue to enjoy golf in a healthy and injury-free way more than at present.
I like that. Playing golf longer, living longer, playing golf later into our lives, all things that that we here at the Golfers Journal are certainly in favor of. As a futurist, as you look ahead, are you bullish? Are you not bullish? How do you feel about the future? And this could be beyond golf. We're living in a pretty scary time, as you mentioned.
Well, I think we are living in a time which has many of the best aspects ever of human history, but also some of the worst aspects of human history. It's a mixture, you know, technology, the free market, the wonderful interplay of consumers and producers has given us so much choice and so many goods. So that's all to be celebrated. It gives us a much wider variety of excellent golf equipment than more than before to come to the golf angle. So there's much to be excited about. And there are many scenarios in which we will be living in the future. I call it a superabundance, a sustainable superabundance, in which there is ample clean energy, ample nutritious food, ample space for everyone. So if I look ahead to 2050, I think there's about a 60% chance we'll be living in a much, much better world overall than today. But there are worrying trends too. We've talked about social media making us in some ways more stupid, more divisive, and causing wars inside families and causing people probably to buy products they shouldn't buy, probably to vote for politicians or political causes which they shouldn't do. I know I'm treading on dangerous territory here, but that is some of the tendencies that are happening. We are becoming, as a society, in some ways more irrational as well as more informed. And there are risks with what we're doing to the weather. You know, we are seeing some more extreme weather, and it could get worse. And there is also worries about pathogens. We are living closer to each other than ever before, with more travel than before. So what's happened with COVID could be a foretaste, dare I say it, of worse to come, especially if there are some sick people who delight in hacking into systems and messing things up. They mess up sometimes our IT infrastructure. They send ransomware or malware to us, and we have to pay. Well, in the future, some people may hack into the biology as well, and there could be pathogens which are very troubling. So there are, without painting too black a picture, there are some worrying trends too. So what's going to determine whether we end up on a wonderful, sustainable superabundance, almost a kind of paradise, which our forefathers would have said if they'd seen us in this, or what's going to determine whether in some ways we are back in a new dark ages? Well, I think it's up to us humans. I think we humans are the biggest influence as to whether things turn out well or badly, and we need to share talk to each other, share our hopes and fears and aspirations, talk about scenarios, which is what futurism's all about. It's about creating scenarios, not because we think they're bound to happen, but because we think they might happen, and therefore we must prepare. It's a bit like when you're in an aeroplane. When you get on board, the flight hostess gives us a kind of a warning. There might be the need for you to find your safety jacket. It's under the seat. There might be a need for you to follow the lights on the corridor to the nearest exit. Be prepared. And that preparation is, in a sense, what futurists are trying to do too. We don't really think we're going to need the equivalent of these safety jackets and lights showing the exit routes. But if we think about it in advance, we may make the changes necessary to avoid the needs for it. And so am I optimistic or pessimistic? I'm both. And I want to be more optimistic. And that's what the discipline of futurism is about. The online meetings of London Futurists, which is an organization I run. But there are many other such groups around the world that look seriously at whether the world could be steered in a way to take better advantage of technology rather than falling victim to misuse of technology.
Must be fascinating conversations, and where, you know, you might have the same people. Do you have the optimists and pessimists, and might have some interesting back and forth, I imagine.
Well, it's important to have that back and forth,
right?
To figure things out in advance. Well, I mean, I talked about airplanes a minute ago. Let's just talk about what happens when an airplane does crash. The airplane industry is very good in searching for the black box, searching for the voice recorder. It was very good in insisting that all aeroplanes should carry such devices, and they study what was recorded in these devices, and as a result they make changes to make airplanes even safer. And although accidents still happen from time to time, they are much safer now than 20-30 years ago. So in the same way, when things are going partly wrong, we need to analyze. We need to say, whoa, let's find out what the cause of this was. Why did we end up with so many people dying from this pathogen? Why do we end up with so much political tension in which we no longer decide things rationally, but we make up our minds based upon whether our favorite politician is seemingly for them or against them? How do we get in this situation? So let's learn from the airline industry there and to do this post-mortem analysis so that we don't end up in a worse state.
So you're 60%, though, I noted, on the sustainable superabundance. I'll take that.
I love the sound of it. There's far too much probability of things going badly wrong, you know? So that's why I can't rest. I keep organizing events to try and lower the probability of bad outcomes.
And you said future prep, use the word, you know, preparing. Futurism I don't get the sense that it's about paranoia, though. Because we have a thing here in the States, preppers, and I'm not criticizing anyone's choice the way that they, you know, that they choose to prepare for the future. But one, I feel like one can, if you live in a vision of the future as inevitably, dark and, chaotic, you sort of lose sight of maybe trying to enjoy today. I don't know if you're living in an apocalyptic future. So I think that's when you're talking about preparation, there's a line, right?
Quite so. If you are paranoid the whole time, you will be dysfunctional, frankly. You won't be able to explore things creatively. So we should be aware of what might go wrong, but not to the extent that it's going to paralyze us. There's a phrase in futurism called future shock, in which people are unable to think clearly. They might just say, wow, this is so cool, I want to have it, without thinking critically about possible side effects. Or instead of saying wow, they may give another three-letter word, yuck, this is horrible, I don't even want to think about it. Or indeed, we might be panicked and become depressed. None of these reactions are helpful. I mean, it might be appropriate to pause. It might be appropriate to take some time out and reflect, but we must come back to action. We must come back to things that will engage, and we must continue to live. So I'm all in favor of not being too dependent on a tight supply chain. The preppers that you mentioned, they acquire lots of things and store it away in safe bunkers. I don't want to go to that extreme, but it is appropriate that we are not suddenly caught short, as happened in the early days of the COVID outbreak, when we could no longer get vital goods. It's because we had organized our society in so-called just-in-time, hyper-efficiency. It lowered the cost by not having extra stock. And it turns out that that's not very good for resilience. So we need to have some preparation built into how we structure society. We need to have some latency, some resilience built in. We shouldn't push ourselves to the limit all the time. It's the same when you're playing golf. You know, you're getting really, really tired. It's probably not wise to keep playing. You know, it's better to ensure that we get good night's rest and the body can recover and then we can play better. So don't go to the limits. And it's the same with preparing for possibly adverse futures. We should raise urgency, but not to the extent that it damages our ability to think constructively about what to do next.
Well said. And it's like that line is a tough one. We all just went through it with the pandemic and trying to, you know, how much toilet paper is too much toilet paper, you know, like all trying to figure out, am I being paranoid or am I being responsible? And I certainly shouldn't critique anyone who was prepared, who was prepping, because I would have knocked on their door and asked for paper towels, you know, a year and a half ago. So fair play to them. Nonetheless, but David, I can't thank you enough for your time and your insights. It's been incredibly interesting. And also, it's just given us a lot to think about. And I love the note that you left us with, that if we are talking to one another, and if we are looking ahead to the possibilities, that we do this notion of that a sustainable superabundance would be within our grasp. I don't know. That's the message I needed to hear today. I'd also love to hear any message as a futurist, if you're good at like the near future in terms of like, I don't know, sporting events, horses, you know, outcomes of that variety would be useful. But I don't imagine your group gets together and does a lot of handicapping.
Well, it's not like in the Back to the Future stories when Biff had an almanac of all the sporting results. So there is no such crystal ball. The only thing you can predict with any accuracy is astronomical events. You know, you can tell when the eclipse of the moon and sun is coming. But even in that case, you know, I think back to 1999 when, with my family, I traveled to Luxembourg to watch the total eclipse of the sun. We knew it would take place, but we didn't know even a few minutes before whether we could see it, because the clouds were blowing in and out and the weathermen couldn't make up their mind whether the clouds would clear or not. So even in that case, there are things to change. A small butterfly flapping its wings is said to be able to cause tornadoes on the other side of the planet. So just one small bounce of a golf ball. Sometimes it bounces into the brook and sometimes it stays short. Sometimes it goes into the hole and sometimes it doesn't, and that changes the course of the whole competition. So, sorry, I can't give you any predictions who's going to win the Masters or anything else, though I will be rooting for Europe to regain the Ryder Cup when that comes around.
Fair enough. David Wood with a glimpse of our tomorrow.